The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.
Navalny, no question, is extraordinarily brave. As journalists, we try not to take sides, but we do side with the truth. We do side with rule of law. We do side with civilization against, you know, these forces of repression. And so in that sense, there is a lot to admire in Navalny's bravery, in his persistence, in his optimism for Russia.
Welcome to the Democracy Paradox podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the democracy paradox. Alexei Navalny is a rock star of democratic politics. He is brash and confident and has actual swagger. Putin tried to kill him, and he not only survived, but he came back to Russia after he recovered. Since then, he was arrested, tried, and imprisoned. Now, recently I came across a biography on Navalny called The Dissident, Profile of a Political Prisoner. The author, David Herzenhorn, is the Russia, Ukraine, and Eastern Europe editor at The Washington Post, and was a correspondent before that for Politico Europe and The New York Times. I reached out to David to discuss Navalny as a person, a politician, and a political prisoner. David provides a lot of details about Navalny's life, but I also wanted to keep the big picture in mind. The question for me in the background of this episode is really, what does Navalny teach us about politics and democracy? Now, I don't actually ask David this question directly, but I think you're going to walk away with some ideas of your own. So please share them with me on social media. My handle on Facebook and X is @DemParadox. You can also share them as a comment on Spotify or a review on Apple Podcasts. If you don't want to share them publicly and you'd rather send them to me directly, you can email me at jkempf@democracyparadox.com. I also want to add that I'm still looking for institutional partners for this podcast. So if you belong to a university, a nonprofit, a company, or a foundation, please reach out to me. I'd love to be able to talk, be able to run some ideas by you. But for now, here is my conversation with David Herzenhorn. David Herzenhorn, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
David, usually start out by introducing the book, but I'd like to kind of break from that just to congratulate you on the new position with the Washington Post as their Russia and Eastern Europe editor. Congratulations. It's an amazing position.
Well, thanks so much. And a challenging one given the war situation.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And obviously, all of us are impressed with the efforts that the Washington Post has been doing, and just their international coverage is just very impressive. But you also have this new book coming out, which was a great read. It's called The Dissident, Alexei Navalny, Profile of a Political Prisoner. It's a fascinating read because Navalny is somebody who's captured just about everybody's imagination who pays attention to Russia. But I didn't know him even as well as I thought I did. Like, I thought I knew more about him than I did. And when I read your book, I feel like I've got a much more complete picture of who Navalny is and what he means. So why don't we kind of start there from like the big picture view? What do you think makes Alexei Navalny so unique and captivating as an opposition figure within Russia?
Thank you just so much. You know, it's exactly what I was hoping people would say when they read this book, because in fact, Navalny is a media creature and a media expert. He's really talented and has been, and his team has been, at shaping his image, in curating and cultivating that. In fact, there are many reasons why certain aspects of Navalny are quite well known and other aspects are not so well known. Some of that is about a Western-Russian divide, but some of that is because of really careful image shaping that they've done. And that's partly why they weren't excited about this book and weren't cooperating with this book, putting aside that Navalny himself, who I'd met previously as a correspondent in Russia, was already in a prison colony when the book project started. But Navalny, as some of his very closest political associates and longtime friends told me, is a political animal. I mean, what makes Navalny so fascinating in many ways, and he describes this being part of this bridge generation between the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation, that people born between 1976 and 1982, who really have vivid memories of what the Soviet Union was like, but then were part of this transition. And somehow in all of that mix, and when Russia really in the early 90s became this freewheeling, almost too free democracy, Navalny caught the politics bug. And he always wanted to be in politics, and he wanted to see himself as a future candidate, still does. And for that reason, the dissident title does not sit well with them. They don't like that at all. We'll talk more about that. But in terms of who Alexei Navalny was and is, and of course, he's been evolving over these years, but he got his start working in local politics in Moscow for Yabloko, a liberal progressive political party, ended up getting ejected from that party, expelled because he was flirting with far-right and nationalist forces, in part because, again, for the real political motivation of trying to find a viable coalition, to forge a viable alliance between anti-Putin forces, anti-establishment forces, that might be able to take on this Kremlin. And it never worked. All he did was get grief for it, and he complains about that, that in the end, it caused him nothing but grief, but he does share some of these Russian nationalist views, but he's not an extremist. He's not a far-right guy. He's never called for violence. But Navalny has always worked in politics, and then he took up this crusade against corruption that really touched a nerve. And there again, it's not that he started out necessarily as an anti-corruption gadfly, although he was perfectly trained for it, it turns out, having trained as a lawyer and having a background in finance. He liked reading, you know, the stock prospectuses and all the fine print, that kind of stuff. But what I think really appealed to him as this got going in the mid to late 2000s was that he touched a political nerve, that he was suddenly hugely popular with this following online with a blog. LiveJournal was the blogging platform in Russia. And he had tapped into this frustration, this anger, this sense among Russians that so much was being stolen from them. Started with the privatization excesses of the early 90s, but then continued as what had been a democracy, market reform, capitalism project run amok, turned into a kleptocracy where Putin and his cronies and people who were in his regime and authorized by him were basically grabbing and stealing everything they could. And Navalny would go and put a spotlight on this. And really, that's when people started talking about him as a future presidential candidate. Now, in other countries, you don't start with people first saying you're going to go for the top job. But in Russia, everything is so focused on that strong executive presidency, what we now know of as managed democracy, but it's really autocracy. And, you know, Navalny started to be seen as someone who could be an alternative to Putin. Certainly, that's how the West embraced him. That dream looks more and more unrealistic now that he's in a prison colony with sentences stacked up totaling 30 years, at least no sign he'll get out. And in fact, he may lose his life in these harsh conditions. But if we want to start there with the who is Alexei Navalny, he is a Russian politician, or that's what he wants to be, and someone who believes that Russia is not destined to be this autocratic, repressive state, but in fact could be a thriving democracy, if only there was a free and fair court system, if only there was a free and fair press, if only there were free and fair elections. He was absolutely convinced that Russia was capable of that kind of a future, that it could head in that direction. It has not happened. In fact, we've seen a much darker turn as Putin has not only pursued this kind of revanchist Soviet imperialist route, but begun a ruinous, awful war in which thousands of people are dying.
So when I look at other countries that are autocratic, countries that we're hoping will become democracies in the future, it seems like in the West, particularly in the United States, we grab on to a singular opposition figure that we can put our hopes into. So for instance, Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar was one example. I think of Nelson Mandela in South Africa is another perfect example. In Russia, for a long time, that person was actually Boris Nemtsov. I mean, he was the original opposition figure that many of us were pinning our hopes on as being the future of Russian democracy. And Alexei Navalny is interesting because he starts to make a name and appear within the West before Nemtsov is assassinated. Like, he exists within the same timeline and exists within many Russian experts' consciousness within that same timeline. What makes Navalny different than Nemtsov was as an opposition figure and as somebody that we think of as a leader that could transition Russia into a democracy one day?
So it's a really interesting question and a great point. And indeed, Navalny and Nemtsov were colleagues. They knew each other. They were on friendly terms. Navalny had seen him shortly before he was killed on a bridge right near the Kremlin. And one thing that Navalny pointed out then is because they were talking about a demonstration, a protest they had planned, that Navalny knew it was impossible that Kremlin agents were not following Nemtsov and watching what was going on. They had to have been on his tail, watching everything that happened, even if they weren't directly responsible and the Kremlin wasn't directly responsible for his assassination. They had to have known. So in Navalny's case, one thing is that he's younger, and Nemtsov actually had served in government as a deputy prime minister, as a governor, a different profile there because Navalny, in fact, and some would say this has been a flaw and a gap in Navalny's resume, he really has not served in government. At one point, he became an advisor, but an outside advisor to Nikita Belyev, who was made the appointed governor of Kirov region. That turned into a lot of headaches for Navalny because he was accused of all kinds of things. And some of the court cases that were brought against him stemmed from that time when he was working as an advisor, outside advisor to a governor, seen as a reform-minded liberal figure. Belyev himself ended up in jail in Russia. And again, you see anybody who has presented a challenge or an alternative to Putin and United Russia, which is his party now, but also the Siloviki, what are known as the security agents, Putin, of course, being KGB officer himself. But for Navalny, he was trying always to forge a new type of political party and a movement partly based in this idea of the anti-corruption work that he'd done. In his view, Nemtsov and others who had gone into politics kind of immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union were part of these initial opposition parties, they had failed. They had never been able to gain a foothold, obviously issues there with Yeltsin and Yeltsin's reelection. But Navalny had this idea that Russia really could build a new system. Now, a lot of complications come into play, but one thing that, as you bring up Nemtsov, I think that's important to keep in mind is just how, in that, again, politician kind of way, Navalny thought he was exceptional. He had come to believe he was something special. Because if you recognize that this guy you're working with was just shot dead on a bridge near the Kremlin, you would think Navalny would have a little bit more foresight about just how dangerous the work was that he was doing. And a lot of people were asking him, why are you still alive? And you'd say he got kind of tired and bored of the question. But certainly at that moment, after an attempted assassination, when he was poisoned with a chemical weapon and had to be medevaced to Germany, when he was thinking about going back to Russia, which he insisted on doing, one would think he would have paused then and said, wait a minute, these guys aren't fooling around. This is not, you know, one of these animated adventure shows that he loves so much, like Rick and Morty. You know, you don't just come back to life after you get poisoned by an FSB hit squad. It takes months, as it did for him. He was in a medically induced coma, but he could not envision himself ever living outside of Russia, and he did not want to be seen as a dissident. First and foremost, that label really didn't sit well because of the Soviet legacy. And also, he did not want to especially be seen as a dissident in exile. He thought that would be the end of his political career. In hindsight, he probably would have had a better chance fighting for the future of Russia had he stayed out of the country, given that Putin was already, we now know, preparing to go to war in Ukraine, and that the fate of one man compared to a country of 40 million that's about to be invaded with thousands dying, vastly underestimated, as maybe all of us did, the extent that Putin was willing to go to try to fulfill this neo-imperialist Soviet revanchist vision of Russia as a restored superpower.
Yeah, before we get into the way that the arc of Navalny's life really kind of showcases the way that the arc of Russia's descent into authoritarianism, like, I feel like those two really parallel each other. I do want to kind of get a better sense of Navalny himself, especially as a politician. One of the things that she just noted was his involvement in the state, I guess I would say, Kirov, where he was a consultant there. And you mentioned how his time there created some complications with the law, that the Russian state tried to bring up corruption charges and stuff that you demonstrate in the book are just a joke, that they're even trying to pursue those charges. But one of the things that you brought up in the book that was really fascinating was that he really went after corruption in that area, but he upset a lot of just the average people in the region. That for somebody who thinks of himself as a politician, he didn't really endear himself with the people when he was actually in charge of public policy. And I just wonder what that experience really tells us about Navalny's strengths and his weaknesses as a politician and as a public figure.
It's a great point. I mean, this is one of the contradictions, and all aspiring politicians, I think, have them in some ways, right? But there was this idea that he was going to succeed where others had failed before him. And I think the difficulty of governing, and again, he wasn't the governor, he was an outside advisor, so he didn't have ultimate responsibility for decision-making. He was advising, but important to keep in mind, and Kirov, I spent time there when he was on trial, and you get the sense of this place in the spring is just full of mud, but this is a region that really relies on the timber industry. It's heavily forested, and Russia, as many of us know, is an extraction economy, but when we think about that, we first think of gas, Gazprom, of oil, Rosneft, Yukos before that. But in fact, another aspect of Russia's extraction economy is the pillaging of its forests and its timber and its wood. And so the entire region lives off of this. And when you have a system that is essentially, this is the whole economy, and the whole economy is built on corrupt schemes, but everybody is living off of this venture, this corrupt venture. When you start to tinker with it and try to reform it, you will encounter huge obstacle and pushback. And that's exactly what happened. There were folks who were extremely angry because he looked at this and said, wait a minute, none of this makes sense. This thing is built to make money. How can it be losing money for the regional government and for Russian taxpayers? And yet, of course, those entrenched interests pushed back immediately very hard on him. And he quickly realized he needed to get out of there, that this was not going well. But, you know, again, to your point about how far-fetched some of these cases were, at every level, the allegations were essentially being thrown out and rejected. Local law enforcement prosecutors didn't want to touch it. Then they tried to push it with regional prosecutors not interested. And finally, Moscow, the investigative committee, insisted on bringing this case, accusing him of, it wasn't even actually embezzlement. It was causing harm as a result of embezzlement. There was really quirky, strange charges that ultimately were brought against him, but they ended up sticking in the sense that they were able to trail him. And then, you know, with a conviction that did bar him from running for office, even as the European Court in Strasbourg of Human Rights throws it out and says, you know, this was not a legitimate conviction. To me, what was most striking actually about the initial trial in Kirov was that there was a judge, he's mentioned in the book, named Sergei Belinov. And this was a guy who was exactly Navalny's age. They're both born in 1976, both part of that post-Soviet generation bridging over to the Russian Federation. They'd gone to law school, followed similar paths in their academic pursuits. And yet one of them became this crusader trying to take on the system and dismantle it. And the other was the servant of the system. He had something like 100% conviction, and he'd been a small village kind of judge and then moved up to Kirov, which is the regional capital. Based on this, because of course, in the Russian system, if you're indicted, if you're charged with something, you must be guilty. Therefore, you're convicted.
end of story. And it really became quite a case study there in how politicized the justice system was already at that point, and it's gotten worse, where Navalny and a co-defendant were convicted. Then there are protests in Moscow, and the next day, it's basically taken back. It's going to be a suspended sentence with an appeal, just sort of ridiculous. And at that point, part of why Navalny's conviction was set aside briefly was to allow him, because somebody in the Kremlin thought it was a good idea, to allow him to run for mayor of Moscow, create the appearance of a real competitive election, even though she was running with A, this threat of jail time hanging over his head, plus no access to media, as candidates, of course, in a democracy need, you know, access to free media and paid media, absolutely overwhelmed by the benefits that the Kremlin was able to bring to the official Putin-approved candidate, Sergei Sobyanin. Interestingly, in a virtual election about a year earlier that was conducted by two news organizations, Navalny won in a giant landslide. You know, they said, who would you vote for mayor? And Navalny won, and Sobyanin, who became the mayor, was a distant fifth or sixth. I can't even remember at this point. But the point is, Sobyanin ended up winning, Navalny getting 30% or so, much more than was ever expected. But of course, the minute that that defeat was locked in and the Kremlin had done this kind of kabuki theater election show, he was in court, demanded sometimes to be in the court in Kirov and a court in Moscow on the same day. And the courts had to deconflict their schedules because his legal troubles were already getting that bad. Just this week, we saw he appeared at a hearing by video. They won't let him out of the prison colony even to attend a court hearing that he had. And he had no legal representation because now three of his lawyers were arrested themselves. Two others have fled and are out of Russia. I mean, it's a complete dismantling of the justice system in Russia just to prevent Navalny from having a platform and an ability to speak to the outside world. So that tells you a little bit about how much he is still hated and feared by the Kremlin even now.
One of the things I got from the book that I find very heartening about Navalny is that he seems very committed to institutions within Russia. For instance, many people thought he shouldn't have run for mayor within Moscow because it wasn't a fair race. It wasn't a fair election. And in many ways, he was being played. I mean, he was being used so that the Kremlin could claim that they were having a free and fair election when really they weren't. By saying, oh, we're going to allow Navalny to be in the race, but we're not going to allow the circumstances for him to actually have a fair vote and for him to actually win. And even if he did win, we're going to stuff the ballot box, whatever it might be, to keep him from actually gaining office. But we're going to make it look like we let him run. Navalny sincerely believes that he wants to be able to get people to participate in the political process, even though it's corrupt, even though it's not legitimate. He wants there to be involvement. He wants to play a role in that process, wants to get people to believe in it. And even within the court system, not only does he go through all of these trials and was willing to come back to Russia to do that, but he looks for every single opportunity to be able to use those institutions to his advantage, such as the many speeches that he gives after he's sentenced. He tries to be able to use those institutions to be able to move them in a way that if Russia was to democratize, that the institutions aren't completely tossed aside, but that hopefully they can be democratized in the process.
Always he has no choice, right? Because there's no other platform. But it wasn't always that way. Let's be clear. There were times when Navalny was calling for a boycott of elections, and he turned against that. He decided that that was a mistake. This was a conscious decision, a recognition that, as you're saying, in a country where there are limited opportunities for public engagement, that it was a mistake to tell people not to participate. So the better course, he decided, was to go forward, campaign as best you can, even when all of the deck is stacked against you. In 2017, 2018, going into what was then a presidential election in 2018, he was running for president, even though his convictions on these trumped up charges barred him from being a candidate. And eventually the court refused to allow him on the ballot. But he was opening campaign offices all over the country, traveling all over Russia, which is not a small place, city to city, opening these local offices, building a team of volunteers, mounting this campaign and telling him, okay, if you're going to shut me down, you're going to be forced to shut me down. But he wasn't going to do it for them. And he developed this system together with his longtime top political aide, Leonid Volkov, called Smart Voting. They were using an app. I mean, the Kremlin has done everything to dismantle this. where it was basically vote for anybody but United Russia, which is Putin's party, the party that is in control of the Duma, the lower house of parliament, and the Federation Council, the upper house of parliament, anybody but. And some of those anybody buts were pretty unsavory characters. And Navalny has been asked about this, like, what about the ethics? You know, we need to break the monopoly, is what he was saying. You have to break this monopoly and show that these people staying in power is not inevitable, that there is a way to defeat them. At one point, they had supported a guy who was old and ill, knowing he was going to die. And Navalny's asked this in an online interview, in a YouTube interview Yuri did about the kind of ethics of the, like, why do you support this guy only hoping he would die and then you can replace him? And in fact, that is what happened. You know, and Navalny admitted that, you know, this was not the most pleasant strategy at times. You do have to hold your nose, but that in fact, they wanted to show that if all these opposition forces could band together and fight against this stacked system, it was possible to win. And they have had some success before it was completely shut down. People chased out of the country or thrown in jail. You know, a miscalculation there of underestimating how far Putin and the machine were willing to go to prevent any challenge and crush any dissent whatsoever.
And while I'm giving Navalny a lot of credit for working within institutions, I'm still struggling because I don't necessarily think Navalny was able to truly build the institutions necessary to be able to challenge Putin, to be able to challenge the Kremlin. And the part of your book that really sticks with me is his relationship with Yabloko, where he really struggled to find a place within that political party. And as you said, was eventually forced out of it, that they actually kicked him out of that political party. It definitely feels that at times Navalny struggles to be able to play well with others, that if he's not in charge, he's having a hard time actually working with other people within their programs, let's say, that he needs to be the star of the show. That's the impression that I'm getting. Is that fair? I mean, is there something I should know about Navalny that's different?
It certainly became fair. It certainly became truer as he grew in fame and stature, and he became seen as kind of the leader of the opposition, that he wanted to be first among equals. Masha Gaidar, the daughter of the former acting prime minister, Yegor Gaidar, has talked about this. She's known Navalny a very long time. And she said she's heard of those times when he was really insisting to be, you know, front and center. But she remembers when he was just starting out in politics and he was a nobody. And it didn't help him at all to be, you know, doing these jobs and working within Yabloko and within a civic group they called the Committee to Protect Muscovites, you know, really retail, grassroots, local politics. There was not a lot of fame, certainly not a lot of money to get out of it. And Navalny had high hopes for Yabloko, but he quickly became very frustrated. And what he realized, and I don't think he was wrong about this, I do think he had a strong point, which was that these opposition forces had become very fatalistic. They were not going to be successful. They sort of accepted the fact that they were not going to be successful, and they were living off the financial flows, the money that would come to being an officially recognized party. He really got disillusioned with Yavlinsky, who was the head of Yabloko, who was a big figure, in many ways, a bigger figure outside of Russia than he was inside of Russia. You know, constant appearances at Harvard and other places in the U.S., recognized as this kind of voice of, you know, a more liberal, progressive, democratic mindset in Russia. But in Russia, he was gaining no traction. And in fact, from the polling results, which we recount in the book, only kept going down and down and down, the number of seats they were able to win in the Duma, et cetera. And Navalny's looking at this and saying he didn't want to be part of a losing proposition. He wanted to win. And he does have an issue. This is a personality quirk where he doesn't back down from fights. This is partly growing up as a military brat, you know, a lot of scuffling, nunchucks. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was his big hero, as Schwarzenegger, you know, Austrian bodybuilder, later California governor, was for many in Navalny's generation. But he's a fighter. He is a fighter. And if he's challenged to a fight, and that is a bit of a danger there, that he doesn't know how to walk away. And that has gotten him into trouble at times where he's really wants to go nose to nose, no matter how unsavory his opponent might be, no matter what the political cost might be. One example was when Igor Strelkov, the former KGB officer involved in the annexation and invasion of Crimea and convicted in a court later in a court in the Netherlands for the downing of MH17, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine, challenged him to a debate. Now, this is a guy who already was being accused of war crimes.
And even so, with Navalny supporters were like, why would you give this guy bandwidth? Why would you get on TV or on video with him on YouTube and give him any credibility? And when he was asked, you know, is he a war criminal? Navalny said, well, that's for a court to decide. Well, in short order, a court in the Netherlands did decide that indeed Strelkov was a war criminal, but challenged to that debate, Navalny was not going to turn it down or walk away from it. But again, starting out, you know, he went with the party that he thought was going to be the one that he could really find common cause with, that he thought had a chance to win something, and very quickly became disillusioned and realized, no, you know, if he stayed with them, he would lose. And so what he needed to do was form his own parties, get out on his own. And that prompted a flirtation with nationalism and the far right. And he does self-identify as a Russian nationalist, not an extremist, but was part of founding a movement called Narod, Nation, looking to see, could there be a kind of mainstream, you know, liberal progressive nationalist movement that would pose a challenge to Putin? It never came together and never quite worked out. But yes, you know, retail politics once upon a time, and then later, indeed wanting to be, and this is part of the image control, you know, to be seen as the leader of the opposition. After Angela Merkel visited him in his hospital room, you know, he said that that was only natural. He's, you know, the leading opposition politician. Why shouldn't the Chancellor of Germany pay him a visit in the hospital? And others look at that and say, well, man, you know, you've never actually been elected to anything. That doesn't happen for everybody, but certainly skilled enough in his messaging to have achieved that stature and recognition and have world leaders, you know, constantly looking after him and asking about him.
So he obviously left Yabloko because he wanted to be able to build a larger, more massive movement that could potentially actually win majority within Russia. How successful has Navalny been at that? Like, at his height, what has his popularity actually been with the Russian people? And of course, I want to add in the caveat that Putin and the Kremlin and United Russia have done everything they possibly can to be able to tarnish his reputation and to be able to make it so he doesn't have as large of a microphone. But I mean, Navalny has been very successful at getting his name out there. What's the reaction from the Russian people to Navalny?
So his anti-corruption work, which began in the mid to late 2000s, was a sensation. He touched a nerve and he loved it. And it was because of the political benefit there, where he realized he'd found an issue that resonated with many everyday Russians, pointing out this awful public graft on an astronomical scale in some cases. Shareholder rights that he would fight for. It turned out he was perfectly trained for this as a lawyer and with a degree in finance. And he liked to read company prospectuses and all the fine print, get into that sort of stuff. Traveled out to Siberia to attend the annual meeting of one of the energy companies. So that work in anti-corruption really did strike a nerve. What we can point to in terms of, you know, how is the public reacting to him when he was allowed to run for mayor of Moscow? He got nearly 30% of the vote, much more than was expected. And that was without any access to free media, where it's to such an extent, not only do they deny him access to the federal channels, but when his name is on the federal channels, it's always in the context of being prosecuted for some sort of malfeasance. So the portrait that's painted for the Russian public of him is quite distorted on mainstream television, one of a criminal, basically, when he's the guy who's been crusading against criminals. If there were free and fair elections, if there were access to media, we have every reason to believe that his popularity would be much higher than it has been. But in fact, Putin doesn't even say Navalny's name. There's only one point, you know, where we know that he spoke Navalny's name when he was asked why he never says his name. And he responds, you know, Navalny is the leader of the opposition. But in fact, you know, it's always this gentleman or the defendant or, you know, the figure you mentioned or, you know, these euphemisms in the same way and to some degree that, you know, it's called a special military operation instead of a war, doing everything he can to never even acknowledge Navalny's existence. Sometimes he's referred to him as another Saakashvili, likening him to Mikhail Saakashvili, the Georgian president who led the Rose Revolution. And Putin actually does seem to believe this stuff. He's convinced himself that these are all revolutionaries who are going to lead popular uprisings and the country's going to spin out of control. There was a lot of fair criticism of Saakashvili, but he ran Georgia as a country, as a responsible leader, welcomed in the West, you know, and then stepped away when his party lost and there was a peaceful transfer of power in Georgia, one of the few that's happened in the post-Soviet space. So from that perspective, you know, Navalny has tried his best to present himself as a credible alternative, helped by his media savvy, YouTube channels, and all the like to make up for this gap. But he has expressed frustration in the past of, you know, the fact that he cannot get the attention that you would need, that is essential to mount any kind of successful campaign, certainly a national campaign in a country geographically as large as Russia is.
So we mentioned earlier that Nemtsov was assassinated, and it was close to 10 years ago now. I mean, it's been a long time. And Navalny's really been the face of the opposition since then, and he was well known even before Nemtsov was assassinated. Why wasn't he put into jail earlier? Why wasn't there an assassination attempt earlier? Why hasn't there been a successful assassination attempt? Like, why has Navalny been allowed to do all the things that he's done for so long?
So there are many theories about this. One is that the failed assassination attempts, and there were several, we believe, were actually failures on purpose. And the attempt was to scare him, to force him to leave the country, to avoid making a martyr out of him. I'm not sure I buy that. I think they're certainly in August 2020 with the poisoning attempt, it seemed they were out to kill him at that point. And he's not the only one. And let's keep in mind, Navalny is also not the only one in jail. Ilya Yashin, a longtime colleague of Navalny's and of Nemtsov, also in jail. Vladimir Karamurza. I mean, the level of repression that's going on in Russia is quite alarming. Navalny, though, was very successful. And in some ways, it was deceptive, even for himself, thinking that he had gotten too popular, too big for Putin to really try to kill or eliminate, you know, put in jail and then throw away the key. But that, in fact, is what has happened. And there, it was an underestimation of what he was up against, that the Kremlin has always done this dance of not wanting to, again, create a martyr. It would accelerate his popular support. So always kind of this back and forth, you know, let him out, push him back. Now, in the case of the assassination attempt in 2020, once he came back, the idea was, okay, you know, he wouldn't die. So now he's going to be put in jail forever. And there are many ways to take a life. I point this out in the book. If poison failed, it would be prison.
I mean, you're right that there's a lot of opposition figures that have been put in jail, and there's been a lot of repression in Russia going back even before 2020, obviously. But at the same time, the trajectory of Navalny's career definitely parallels the trajectory of Russia, moving from a repressive state to something that a lot of people would consider to be competitive authoritarian, like still having some democratic aspects to it, even though elections were not free and fair. It's definitely moved over the course of the past few years, particularly since 2020, probably highlighted by Navalny's arrest and his attempted assassination, has really descended into something that's a much darker form of autocracy during that period, highlighted by the war in Ukraine and the repression against the press and everything else within Russia. I mean, can we kind of connect the dots in terms of a real shift within Russia that happened, in terms of the shift that they began treating Navalny differently at a certain stage?
Sure. But you're also reminding me why you're called the democracy paradox, right? I mean, this is the democracy paradox. Democracy is our greatest strength, and it's also our weakness. The fact that Putin can look at photographs of the G7 or the G8, and he's the only one left standing because all those other bozos have to face, you know, elections or term limits. You start to see how democracy creates an Achilles heel for societies and allows someone like Putin to create this managed democracy and also a false bargain. When I lived in Moscow, the parks were beautiful. The Moscow subway, the stations are like museums, you know, art exhibits, each and every one of them. And the train comes every 30 seconds. It's amazing. And I'll go back home to New York and I'm in Midtown Manhattan and waiting for a train 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It's, you know, middle of a work day. Where is the train? And this is the false deal that's made. Living in Moscow can be really nice and pleasant. And in exchange, you don't have free and fair elections for the mayor or for the president. And Navalny's trajectory indeed matches this growing authoritarianism on Putin's part, this tightening of the authoritarian fist over time, no question about it. You know, and he's also a creature, as you say, of the aspects of freedom that folks who had lived in the Soviet Union really enjoyed. And this is part of the problem, and it explains Putin in many ways. I mean, there are folks in Russia who remember how bad it was during Soviet times, who remember how the country was practically starving, literally starving, at some points in the 1990s. And Putin rode this wave of rising oil and gas prices. And now you go to a supermarket in Russia and you can find everything you can find in an American big box store, plus more, you know, stuff from Asia, imports that you don't get so easily in the United States. And people say, okay, life is not that bad. And it's actually pretty good, but it is a false bargain where, you know, can content yourself to a nice life and yet you're not truly free. And indeed, you know, one example, it's a tiny small detail, but some folks point to it as a reason why the White Ribbon protests in Moscow, which in Russia, which followed end of 2011, going into 2012, Putin announces he's coming back to the presidency, right? He'd swapped with Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev, who'd been prime minister, becomes president, called the tandem switch. And just this complete disrespect for the democratic system where there's supposed to be an election and Putin announces not only is there not going to be a free and fair election, but he's just coming back. And after that, there was a parliamentary election that was rife with fraud and with cell phone cameras, you know, suddenly everybody could see the fraud happening. I mean, the stuffing of the ballot boxes and everything else. And Navalny, you know, starts to skyrocket to fame at some of the protests that followed that election. But at one point, having been arrested at a protest, he spends 2 weeks in jail. He comes back out, attends another protest. This is in December of 2011. A week or so later, we're at the New Year holidays in Russia, right? Christmas, New Year holidays. And Navalny is doing interviews from Mexico, where he's on vacation. He's part of this generation. He met his wife at a resort in Turkey. You know, this is a generation of Russians who became accustomed to going out and being able to travel the world and enjoy the sights, etc. And so there's Navalny in Mexico, you know, logging on to Live Journal and blogging and talking up the ongoing protests, you know, and as some people, including Masha Gaidar, said, you know, those protests in those months, as impressive as some of them were, because there'd been nothing like it for years, they were too happy. That in fact, the protesters were going out and picketing and denouncing Putin in between hanging out with each other at a trendy bar, or going to the movies or whatever it was. And life was just too good to sustain a real uprising that would potentially topple the government. And in that sense, Putin has been very crafty in keeping the quality of life, at least in the big cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg, high enough that, you know, Navalny trying to make the case that life is miserable in the farther reaches of Russia, you know, hasn't been able to get as much traction as he would have if they had let the subways fall apart or the parks, Gorky Park that I wrote about, you know, the makeover, which is one of the most beautiful parks in the world. And now it creates this very strange, and from folks that I've talked to who have been back, you know, sinister situation where, you know, there's this awful, horrific war going on. And then you've got, you know, still these trendy, beautiful restaurants and, you know, life going on as normal in Moscow, except when some drone is attacking. It's a very good point that, in fact, Navalny and Putin have been sort of in parallel, with Putin really, you know, keeping his foot on Navalny's throat, so to speak, the entire time. And even saying at one point, Navalny had a choice. He could have stayed out. He could have stayed out of the country. He came back. So he was arrested. There's nothing to talk about.
You call the book The Dissident. You've mentioned the fact that Navalny's people don't like that word. Navalny doesn't like that term, being called a dissident. It implies that there isn't really a next step for him. So let me ask you, like, being a dissident, what is the next act for Navalny? Does he have a political future?
Looking very, very bleak, to be honest. And let's talk a little bit about this dissident label, which he really disdained and did not ever want. And Leonid Volkov, his closest advisor, longtime head of the Anti-Corruption Foundation and his campaign manager for all the campaigns and almost campaigns that Navalny's ever run. We talked about this. Navalny and his people viewed the Soviet dissidents as admirable, honorable, and brave as they were. Navalny and his people saw them as losers. Not losers in the colloquial sense. They really admired them, but losers in that they never won anything. The lucky ones were able to get out of prison. They were able to escape to the West, to the United States, or to Israel, where they were greeted as heroes. They were able to speak out, but in fact, they never were able to change Russia in the way that they wanted. And Navalny never wanted to be seen that way. He wanted to be seen as a politician, as a candidate, as a future leader of his country. And he especially never wanted to be seen as a dissident in exile. He thought that would spell political death. And that's why he went back. After confronting almost real death in being poisoned, he insisted on going back, thinking that if he stayed out of the country, his political career would be over. In hindsight, that might not have been true, because what Putin was about to undertake with the war in Ukraine might mean that a very different type of transition would need to take place, and that perhaps a government, a future government forming in exile, would be one of the only paths forward. Right now, the way we look and what we see is Navalny has got these sentences of 30 years stacked up, Putin in office potentially until 2036 or beyond. If Navalny survives prison, it's very hard to see how he has a political future, in part because his evolving views and evolved views on Ukraine have now brought him in direct opposition to many of the people that he would need to vote for him for president of Russia. Navalny has now come out very forcefully against the war, declaring that Ukraine's 1991 borders need to be respected, though he'd waffled a bit on Crimea in the past, that Ukraine is due compensation and Russia should pay compensation using its oil and gas revenue. It's hard to see how that catches on with a public that at the moment, thousands of Russians who are losing husbands, brothers, sons, fathers in this war that Putin has convinced them is just and necessary. As much of all of us realize it's a war of aggression, there was no need for this. And so in that sense, it's hard to envision a political future for Navalny unless there is the kind of reckoning in Russia that there was in Germany after World War II. And that would only come about with the total defeat of Russia. And we don't see that as likely, in part because Russia has the world's biggest nuclear arsenal, and Putin and his allies have even threatened that if there's an existential threat to their state, they would detonate a nuclear bomb. Now, that seems crazy, given it would have to be next door. But in fact, that is the threat. And it's hard to see how there would be that kind of defeat and that kind of reckoning. So Navalny's challenges at this point are to survive the very harsh conditions, and they are extremely harsh conditions in a Russian prison colony. And if he survives, then to see, could he build a political movement with everybody who has been in opposition in Russia now either jailed or exiled? I mean, dissent has been completely crushed. Now, a sort of corollary to this, and we haven't talked about, is that Navalny has at times, and he's very distrusted, if not despised, in Ukraine at the moment, because he's viewed as a Russian nationalist and also as a Russian imperialist. And what many people don't know, and this is part of the carefully managed profile and image, is that Navalny himself is half Ukrainian. His father was born in Ukraine. Navalny is half Ukrainian. And so when Navalny has said things that seem to echo Putin's view that Russia and Ukraine are brother nations, he said he thought it was inevitable that one day Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus would all live together as one country again. When Navalny looks in the mirror, a Russian and Ukrainian being the same person, that's him. That's true. That's his reality. That's how he grew up. He spent all of his summers as a kid until he was 8 years old in this village where his grandparents lived, right near the Chernobyl nuclear power plant where his father was born before the plant even existed. And then one spring comes and they said, well, don't send Lyosha this year. There's been an accident. There was a meltdown. His family had to evacuate. They had to leave. He's gone back and seen his grandparents' abandoned house in the exclusion zone, inside on the floor, a jacket that he used to wear as a kid when he was there for these summers. And so this war has been quite a personal tragedy for Navalny, and also presented him with this incredible political quandary, which is, how, again, do you, as a politician, walk this tightrope? I mean, in 2014, and let's remember, this war started in 2013, 2014, when Ukraine was on the brink of signing political and economic agreements with the EU, and Putin pushed back on that. The Maidan Revolution happens because Yanukovych has broken his promise to sign those agreements, says he's not going to sign. Then Putin invades. After Yanukovych flees, Putin invades Crimea and annexes Crimea in violation of international law. But at that point, and I was living in Russia then, the taking back of Crimea was hugely popular. I mean, Crimea is a place that so many Russians know as a summer vacation destination. When I try to explain it to Americans, they say, look, you have to envision that by some quirk of history, the United States lost South Florida, and not just South Florida, Orlando. And what would happen if then some president grabs it back? When people say, oh, that's a violation of international law, or would they say Disney nosh, Disney is ours? And that's what Russia was saying. In the word cream nosh, Crimea is ours. Again, violation of international law, but the genuine public sentiment. And so Navalny tries to have it both ways, right? He's a politician recognizing, you know, to be against Crimea as part of Russia, or to be against the idea that Crimea is Russian, a place where most people are native Russian speakers, was untenable. And yet at the same time saying, look, but this was a violation of international law. The referendum should have been done differently. There was no legal way to carry out the annexation that Putin carried out. And in fact, it was very much an invasion. Some folks like to say there was not a shot fired. I was there. There were shots fired. I can play the video or you can hear the gunfire in the background. But the point being that Navalny then goes on the radio and he's pushed on this and even is asked, pressed by Venediktov, the head of Echo Moskvy Radio, you know, would you give Crimea back if you ever became president? And he says, what? Is Crimea a bologna sandwich to pass back and forth? Of course, this infuriated Ukrainians. And they also are infuriated by this idea of, you know, Russia and Ukraine as brother nations, especially now after the big invasion in 2022. But for Navalny, this was sort of a natural thing. This is how he grew up, is Russians and Ukrainians being one and the same. But since then, because of the war and because of his own persecution, Navalny has evolved and clarified his views, come out very forcefully against the war, come out very strongly for compensating Ukraine, withdrawing the troops immediately, calling for Russia to eventually be a parliamentary republic, weaken the overly strong presidency. He sees that as the way forward. But the political quandary is that he is not trusted by Ukrainians who see him as a Russian nationalist and a Russian imperialist, don't realize that he's half Ukrainian. And don't even care because they say, look, Putin has this concept of the Russian world, the Ruski Mir, and that Navalny's complaint was never about that sort of Russian superiority, that Russia should lead this, you know, Slavic coalition. But in fact, he was mad that Putin was undermining it, that Putin was screwing it up. And what Ukrainians would like is for him to recognize Ukrainians have their right to self-determination. They are a distinct nation with a distinct history. On some levels, Navalny has admitted that, even expressing envy that Ukrainians twice rose up, took to the streets for democracy. The Orange Revolution in 2004-2005, Maidan Revolution in 2013-2014, and showing how much they want democracy, and Navalny asking, you know, will Russians ever do this? There has not been a sign of that kind of push in Russia. But if you think about Yanukovych, who was president of Ukraine when the Maidan Revolution happened, things were tough. He was facing sustained protests on the streets, some violence, including police shooting at protesters. But at some point, Yanukovych fled. He decided, for legitimate reasons or maybe imagined reasons, he was going to run, and he fled and took refuge in Russia. He had the military and the police at his command. Fast forward to Zelensky in 2022, who's got the world's second biggest military, the largest nuclear arsenal, bearing down on him and refuses to leave his capital when he's offered a ride, famously by the West, to get him out. So again, for Navalny, you know, there's much to admire in Ukraine, but for Ukrainians, there's much to suspect and worry about in Navalny. So not well-loved on the Ukrainian side. On the Russian side, distrusted because he's portrayed over and over again as some kind of traitor, some kind of extremist. I mean, it's laughable because if Navalny is an extremist, it means that demanding free elections and democracy is extreme. He's never been one to call for violent protest. All he's done is make a lot of jokes and poke fun at the horrific, ridiculous theft and graft by Putin and his cronies, and then later complaining about, you know, this murderous war of aggression.
Whenever I read like a biography, I find that the biographer either admires the person that they're writing about, or they portray them as a villain and they very much disrespect that person. Reading this biography, I get the impression that you greatly admire Alexei Navalny. I mean, it comes across that you have a very supportive vision of him and that you admire him a lot. Do you see him as somebody that you think of as a hero just on a personal level?
It's interesting you say that because I think that people close to him, you know, would very much object to some of the spotlight on his nationalism, even on his racism. He's somebody who's used racist language in the past, in the personal context, you know, with a coworker at Yablica at one point, even though he denied it, it's fairly well established that in fact he's used these slurs. I would say that what I hope we've achieved in this book is a news-driven biography that portrays Navalny in a realistic way, not overly heroic, as some of his supporters do portray him. He does see himself as kind of leading a band of superheroes. And it's funny, but also true that they're on these adventures. You know, one day they're, you know, going after Medvedev and his palatial estates that he's got. Another day, tackling the prosecutor general's family who's grown rich with, you know, owning a luxury hotel in Greece or whatever it is. Navalny, no question, is extraordinarily brave. As journalists, we try not to take sides, but we do side with the truth. We do side with rule of law. We do side with civilization against, you know, these forces of repression. And so in that sense, there is a lot to admire in Navalny's bravery, in his persistence, in his optimism for Russia. There was a former Russian television broadcaster, Yevgeny Kiselyov, who had left Russia because it was obviously uncomfortable and lived for many years in Kiev and then had to leave Kiev because Kiev became uncomfortable for Russians to be there. And I saw him recently at a forum, a conference in Vilnius. And Kiselyov said, you know, Navalny is extraordinarily brave and his bravery is absolutely senseless. And I think that sums it up. There's a bravery that at some point is no longer serving his cause because he's now unable to fight the fight that he needed to fight. Now, his folks hope, and his family especially, that he will emerge as a Mandela. It may take decades, but that he will emerge able to lead his country. I'm not sure that the circumstances exist for Navalny to lead that kind of reconciliation. I'm not sure, given his inherent personality as a fighter, that conciliation is his strong suit. I think, you know, he is someone who, you know, given a foothold, would be able to lead Russia toward a democratic future if sort of all of Russia was behind him. But if Russia is divided and fractured and broken and broke, which it may be, depending on how long this war goes on, I'm not sure that Navalny is the one who can bring the country together. Certainly, given the opportunity, he would try. So much, much to admire about Navalny, as with any aspiring politician or active politician, a lot to scrutinize, a lot to hold to account. You know, there should be tough questions. I think there are times when you see the very carefully managed image. His wife, Yulia, does interviews when she knows they'll be published as Q&A, kind of a transcript form. They like a TV format or a video format where, you know, he knows his voice will dominate. It's less fun or less interesting when you have print journalists who are going to filter what's said and hold him up to a spotlight. And there, I think, like every politician, you know, he will stretch the truth. Sometimes he'll take credit for things that other people deserve credit for. You know, some of his early successes, even in anti-corruption fighting, he had chips from other people about targets to go after. And, you know, very quickly, you know, that original source gets brushed aside. And Navalny is presented as the hero in that episode of fighting Russian corruption. But, you know, there's no question. I mean, it's impossible not to admire somebody who is willing to stand up for their country, for freedom and democracy, for the idea that Russians should be able to chart their own future and have a say in what their government looks like and have a right to know that their country's not being pillaged with the resources, whether that's oil, gas, or timber being stolen, or it's, you know, straight out of the treasury, you know, and a fake tax refund has happened with Magnitsky.
Well, David, thank you so much for talking to me today. I want to plug the book one more time. It's called The Dissident, Alexei Navalny, Profile of a Political Prisoner. It's a fascinating read. For anybody who's interested in Russia, this is a great read because it has a very specific focus on a person who we read so much about, we learn a lot about, but this is the first great biography that I've come across on him. So it was great read, very informative. Thank you for talking to me. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you. And for anybody who's interested in the paradox of democracy, because Navalny is one of the paradoxes of democracy, you don't get the perfect candidate. You get the ones that rise. And certainly he's found a way to rise and he represents that paradox. So I'm really glad we got to talk about it here on this show that is so aptly titled for a subject like this.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.
The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.